Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right, so I'm with Brendan from Def Glock. So how are you doing today?
I'm good so far. How about you?
Good, thank you. So I know you guys have a lot going on, a lot on your plate right now. You're about to release, is it your fourth album?
Yeah, that's right. Def album 4 is coming out next week alongside with a soundtrack album and the movie Army of the Gangster.
I see that it's been like 10 years since your last album, but I imagine it takes a lot more work into it because not only are you creating an album, you're also creating animation and a storyline. Can you talk a little bit about what goes into that? And I'm sorry, I feel like I just jumped into the heavy stuff right away.
No, that's all right. That's fine. Yeah, absolutely. I think this is people are curious. How do you serve up all this stuff at the same time? And I think it's kind of like when you go to a restaurant and you order your food, everything takes a little bit kind of different time to prepare. But you got to get it all out at the same time. So, you know, you braise the beef, you flash fry the fries at the end, whatever it is, and then you kind of serve it up. So I'm always kind of toggling between, you know, the movie and the narrative always comes first. I'm a writer first, and then I'm kind of an actor and guitarist and musician after being a writer. But I'm a writer of music first, and then I'm a performer second, you know, and I'm a writer of scripts first and a performer second. So it's the writing that always comes first. And while I'm writing, I'm also kind of like sculpting out the sound of the movie, the score of the movie. So I'm even when I have a script ready, I record all the voices myself, and I do impressions of the other actors and everything. And I start to listen to the whole timeline, and I start putting in music if I want to accentuate a moment or make something more intense, more kind of eerie, more grandiose, more epic. That's where I start playing with music. Meanwhile, I'm demoing every single day, like throughout the pandemic, song after song after song after song. Like a pull, it's like pulling a lever at like a slot machine, and you just kind of go, okay, nothing. Oh, hey, look, I won, and then that's what you're doing. And then slowly but surely I'm selecting the songs that I think are in the movie, the songs that I think are on the record, the songs that I think maybe won't cross the finish line, and all that stuff's happening. And it's really crazy because meanwhile, the whole time I'm in this trance, I'm not really me. I'm thinking as if I'm Death Clock and Nathan Explosion, and the characters are kind of telling me what to do.
So that's wild. Like, I just, you know, I've spoken to a lot of magicians before.
Yeah.
But to me, like, I feel like you just live in this outside realm. Like, you're not really yourself. I feel like your job is so much harder because you have to think as a different person. And then it's not just music writing to you. It's storytelling and so much more. Like, it seems like you have, like, four jobs in one role.
But it is all the same thing to me, you know, it's no different to me. It's like, it all came, I mean, yes, I'm a writer and I have been a writer, whether or not I knew it my entire life. I've always been journaling and writing, and maybe it's therapeutic or whatever, but the guitar was the same way too. I took a real interest in it. I wanted to learn about it. I wanted to learn how the chords worked. I studied it. I went to music school and all that. But ultimately I started to realize everything's kind of a guitar here. Like from directing the movie, a timeline of a movie, a story of a movie is a story of a song. And by the way, there's so many artists out there that don't even write personal things out there. They write stories. And these are like great musicians from Joni Mitchell to Randy Newman to, like, you know, people that have nothing to do with heavy metal, but also heavy metal. I mean, heavy metal is like, even Metallica writes about stories and movies and ideas. One is from, you know, Johnny Got His Gun, and it's this kind of inward journey that was inspired by that movie. So I think it's sometimes having a story and using characters makes the job a little bit easier, because having a story is everything. It gives you so many different places to write music, and writing a score and having an A theme that is like my good guy theme, and a B theme that is my bad guy theme. Just the fact that I have those two ideas makes the rest of my job so much easier, because now I can interpolate them, do the inverse, do the retrograde, pull out three notes from it and make it its own thing, and just use this like expository statement to continue to flesh it out and change it and mutate it. So
I feel like that's something that, like, this generation, I think music today is great because it, like, speaks to emotion and inner, mm-hmm. like, inner turmoil, where I feel yeah. like, you know, music, like, 40 years ago is more storytelling. And so I think you have this really cool dynamic where you get to combine both. And I don't see it a lot in today's music.
You know, I don't. I mean, there, when I think about, like, when I grew up with music, I grew up in the 80s, and every song on the radio was a gorgeous pop hit that was heartachy and tragic and wonderful. Like, seriously, from Chicago to, like, mm-hmm. Huey Lewis to, like, Van Halen, like, 5150, all those songs are so emotional. And they were really, and then there was an era of songwriting where people were really, like, interested in harmonic changes and content and getting your ear to get excited about something, where right now it is more about it's about groove and mood and all that stuff, which I think is also cool. And, you know, I think about other popular artists like Billie Eilish and stuff, where I think, oh, what is Billie Eilish doing? She's got this wonderful, tragic kind of melancholy that everyone feels. And she is tapped into that. So I think about all that. All that stuff, I think, is it's always been there. But every once in a while, an artist will challenge themselves to write music that sticks with you. The changes are interesting. There are some surprises. But, yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you write the music you wish people were writing, then you may be in a good place.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So I know you guys are getting ready for a tour. Mm-hmm. What goes into those preparations? Like, I know you must be just a million directions all at once.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, part of it is this, which is promoting all day, every day, and telling the story of the show, the songs, the movie, all that stuff. But it's also making sure that, you know, this is kind of my project now. I've become a little bit more entrepreneurial in the side of, you know, arranging and putting money down and all that for a tour. So I am, like, very interested in the bottom line. Mm-hmm. Make sure we're not spending too much here. So, like, all that stuff, which is also being a director of a movie. Where are we at with our budget? Let's not overspend. Let's use our money wisely. Let's do this. Let's do that. Is there a shorter way here or there, whatever? So you're, like, asking all those questions. And then making sure the rest of your band's available, excited, and knows the music. And we sit there, and I Zoom with Neely Brosh the other day, and we talk about dividing up the parts. She knows, like, she'll learn the whole song, and I'll go, okay, so I'll do this, you do that. Got it. Okay, cool. Oh, no, it's not this chord. That's a B minor 7. So, yeah, do that. Okay, cool. And so we'll just, like, talk through all that stuff. And I'm somewhat of a musical director, but I also have such great musicians I work with that they kind of take over, too. Mm-hmm. And, like, working with a bass player like Brian Beller, he's almost like a musical director, whether or not he wants to be. And he'll just make sure that everyone's just kind of taking care of the project, you know?
Yeah.
I remember, like, I've been in rehearsals with Brian Beller before where he said, okay, stop. Listen, you know how we messed that up 2 times in a row? And I go, yeah. Everyone goes, yeah. And he goes, why don't we make a decision to not do that? And everyone goes, yeah, that's a good idea.
Oh, it's that easy.
Yeah, it really, and sometimes it is to say, like, you know, we're noticing the mistake is happening, but we're moving. We're, you know, we're kind of blindsided by the amount of parts we have to kind of get under our fingers, hands and feet. And sometimes it's just basically saying, hey, let's not do that stupid mistake anymore that we all collectively are doing. So there's that, getting the gear there, making sure I have enough strings and picks from, you know, the people at MXR Dunlop, and making sure, like, whatever it is that my rig is going to be is up and running. If I have a B rig, it's all boring minutiae stuff, but ultimately we'll get in the room, we'll all kind of negotiate our monitor situation, and then eventually we'll play and have fun. And with these kind of musical perfectionists, we'll just make it our goal to have the absolute best show we can possibly have every single night, and then keep pushing it and making it more exciting and complicated with, you know, in our own way as we continue forward.
Right. So when the album comes out, you know, there's like an animated aspect of it with Metalocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, how do you translate when you're on tour?
Yeah.
Is it?
How do you translate the animated
yeah.
section of it, right? Well, we thought of that. We have a gigantic movie theater-sized LCD screen behind us. And
okay.
we have animation playing the entire show. In fact, it's so like articulated that we have a click track running through the drummer's headset, and so every downbeat is coinciding with a cut. Every major part of the song is kind of represented in the animation. And and you put that together, the synergy between the live music and the visual ends up being a really fun thing. So it feels kind of like an amusement park ride. Like if you walk into Universal Studios and there's a big room and there's a band on stage and a gigantic animated performance happening. And that's what this feels like. It's something from Universal Studios.
Okay. So is there like more or less at stake when like you don't have to be yourself as like this huge persona, but you get to kind of be this animated character?
Well, yeah, I don't have to be the character. In fact, the idea is this. We sound like Death Clock. We are not Death Clock. Death Clock is right behind us on that screen. We are, we even joke that we're the Metalocalypse players. And Death Clock, you know, is, you know, a figment of our imagination, but we sound exactly like them. It's crazy how much we sound exactly like the record, you know, because we made the record, you know? So that's the idea. So we're almost like, I consider it like a ballet with a pit orchestra also on stage. No.
Does that take some of the pressure off of you guys, just knowing, like, oh, well, you know, eyes aren't on us, they're on the screen behind us?
For me, look, this whole thing from directing a movie to making records and music and score to playing live is a job that's perfectly crafted for me and my personality, in that I both get to be in the spotlight and not at the same time, which is the ideal place for a person like me.
That, man, that sounds, it's just like such a cool dynamic. Like, you don't hear this often, so it's just, it's kind of wild. I feel like you're in a really special spot here.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is how can you have a job where you're really in competition with nobody?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, no one else is doing this. I mean, the Gorillaz were doing it, and they were definitely an inspiration, but our narrative kind of, like, is different, and it's more vast, and this movie kind of brings the whole thing together, really, like, from the whole narrative and the ideas of music and everything that we've been talking about. It's all in this movie, too, and it's big, and it's much bigger than our series ever was, and it's much more character-driven than our series ever was, and it's much more cinematic than our series ever was, and we just really wanted to kind of, like, throw down the gauntlet and really, you know, throw down a challenge and see if everybody accepts it and can collaborate and not only keep up, but beat it with a cooler idea, so that there's a big collaboration happening all the way from, you know, the players in the band, to the artists that we work with, to the storyboard artists, to the animators, to the compositors. I want them all to feel a little bit of ownership and really join me on this insane, you know, ride that's really like minutia-based work. We're all kind of insane in our own way. We all have like some kind of cocktail of ADD, OCD, whatever it is, to get into the minutia, from guitar to every single time, accounting for everything. Is a pretty nutty place to be, but that's how we have fun.
Yeah. So can you get into, without giving too much away, but get into the character arc or the story that fans can expect?
Absolutely. So this movie, Army of the Doomstar, takes place directly after the last incarnation we did, which is the Doomstar Requiem, a one-hour-long rock opera special that we recorded with a 50-piece orchestra and a heavy metal band. So this takes place directly after that, and it follows the lead singer, Nathan Explosion, who is very much kind of suffering some kind of post-traumatic stress from the recent incarnation, the Doomstar Requiem, and he kind of finds himself in the middle of an emotional and professional flat spin, and his life is a disaster, which is when he gets tasked with having to write a song that may or may not save the world. And that's what this is about. So this is about creativity under
no pressure.
Exactly. It's kind of like, the crazy thing about this show is that it is always somewhat parallel to the making of the show, and this is no different, where the pressure's on how do you write this song that may or may not save the world. And so that's what it is, like creativity under duress. It's also about relationships of, you know, a band with itself and a band with the outside world. And this is about celebrityism and the ego and masculinity and all these crazy tragedies that come with it. And we definitely like push the envelope in every way and try to make it as visually spectacular as we can.
Sounds amazing. So I remember, you know, a few years ago, Notre Dame was on fire.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? And then all the people were just so heartbreaking for the art. And I feel like that moment in our history showed that creativity and creative works were not just, I mean, they are necessities. Some people can say that it's just kind of like, I don't know, like an accessory to life, but no, it actually is necessity. And I like that theme that you just put in to show in a very exaggerated sense that creativity is necessary for life. And like, maybe it won't ever be in the real world of like saving the world, but it could save the world to one person. So I love that theme.
Yeah. Well, that really is about, seriously, this is, when you think about this show and what it is, this is about a creative family existing in, you know, in strange times. So it's also, when you're as bombastic and over the top and insane and stupid as it is, it's also a workplace comedy where, in this case, this is our job is to be creative together. And I did a show before that was about the same thing. It was home movies. It was a completely different vibe and feeling and delivery system, but it was also about a creative family. And I know that throughout my life, there's been therapy in art, from journaling when I was a teenager to sitting behind a guitar to painting to whatever it is. Like, I can't but do it because I don't know how to survive without it. You know, it's almost like having a dog. Every dog is an emotional support pet, and every piece of art that you try to endeavor is therapy in some way. So it's all crazy therapy, and it is therapeutic. And when you get behind a microphone and scream, going back to like primal scream therapy too at the same time. So everything's the making of this project, as crazy as it sounds like it is, and it is crazy and it's daunting and terrifying, but it's therapeutic, and that's what I'm in it for, the making of it. All this other stuff, the playing, all that stuff is icing on the cake, but the making is the real thing that gets me excited.
Oh, yeah, and I feel like just, you know, a very niche set of people are going to really, truly understand that.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's, and that's why the show is back, because of those people that have forged a relationship with it and kept at it and kept our numbers up, because we wouldn't be doing this if our audience weren't there for us. Nobody would risk any money on this project unless they believed that there was some kind of return. So
I remember it being on Adult Swim, you know, so many years ago, and I read that this is coming out on DVD. Is there going to be a place where people can stream it, or do those diehard fans just have to get the DVD and have that, like, personal ownership of it?
Well, first of all, it's a Blu-ray, which means it's a higher quality. And by the way, this is, like, also part of – I'm an avid physical media collector, especially with movies and Blu-rays and all that stuff. And why do I care about that? Because no one can take that away from me. No one can stop streaming it, you know, at some point. No one can take it out of the library. I get to own it. And also the sound is better, 5.1. We really mix this with we really tried to be creative with the mix, as we were creative with, you know, the visuals, we were creative with the music. We wanted the mix to be a creative and immersive kind of thing too, an experiential thing. So I am always the one that says, buy the Blu-ray, you won't regret it, and buy your other favorite movies on Blu-ray. You'll notice they look better than streaming, always.
Oh yeah.
That's first thing. And then secondly, this will be available for streaming, so you can buy or rent it, I think on whatever, like Amazon, Apple, whatever it is. And then I believe it's going to land on, and then again, I say I believe because I never know how these companies shape shift as they go. It's supposed to land at some point on Max, which is where the series is now.
Okay. Gotcha. So, and then the soundtrack is going to be separate, but I fully believe you should watch the movie before just streaming the soundtrack. But
absolutely, yeah. Yeah, watch the movie first, and then I think that's what I think is the movie. The record's going to come out first. You'll probably check stuff out, but the context will reveal itself in the movie. And then the soundtrack, yeah, the score and all that stuff, that to me was one of the most enjoyable endeavors, was scoring the movie, because I love film scores. I studied it in school, never got an opportunity really other than, I mean, tons of TV scoring, but not a feature and not a three-act structure where I really got to sink my teeth into the moodiness of it, the sound, the emotion, and all that stuff, which really contradicts the Death Clock record, which is really brutal, super heavy. We came back with, you know, with a vengeance, and it's really aggressive, this record, but also melodic and mystical and epic on, you know. So, yeah, the soundtrack, I'd say all these things kind of do something the other doesn't do. The emotional and beautiful is on the soundtrack. The brutal and heavy and epic and mystical is on the Death Clock record, and the story and the character and the heart and the emotion are in the movie.
I actually have a film background.
Oh yeah.
And like this interview is so fun because it mixes my background and then what I'm doing, which doesn't happen often, where like you get to translate, you know, visual elements and the like kind of almost, it's almost like a science of what you can do with music to portray what you're seeing on screen, and it's just it's so exciting to see that.
Yeah, isn't that what the definition of cinema is?
It's like almost the five senses, maybe three senses.
Yeah, but it's telling a story with visuals plus music, and that's cinema. And there are moments in this movie where I was so excited to be able to remove all dialogue and have like a 2 or 3 minute sequence that's fueled by score or by a song and let the action, the visual action, take over. So there are a few places where we really got to say, look, no dialogue, just mood, just feelings, and just sound, you know, and visuals.
That's actually how I love to storytell. Like when I work a little bit, and not, I wouldn't say the music or the movie industry, but it's a big part of what I do outside of Side Stage Magazine. But it always starts with the music for me, and I feel like that's just like the root of storytelling. That's how you get that emotion, like don't tell, but you have to hear it too, and hearing makes you feel it, and it connects you to that character, and it's so hard to explain to people, but it's just such a crucial element,
and it's not taken advantage of enough. For example, so when you're a writer and you're writing something and your objectivity is out the window, what do you do? And what we did was I recorded the entire script and I played every single character, you know, as a placeholder just to see how it was landing, you know? And that's when I did a V1 of the score at the same time to enhance the subtext, the mood, the kind of subterranean elements sonically, and, you know, the character and the arc. And that's where I got a V1 of the score, which is great because I was writing it originally and I didn't temp anything in there. So you get something that's a little bit more unique. And not something that's like doing an offshoot of a temp score that already existed.
Gotcha. So, and you mentioned earlier about this project has been entrepreneurial. So are you doing this independently?
No, I mean, the entrepreneurial part is the tour. I would say the everything else is like, you know, the money was given through Adult Swim. And again, it was a budget that was like, okay, for an animated film, this is not a huge budget. So how do we Roger Corman this and punch up, or, you know, James Cameron this, punch up above our budget with cool decision making in art, in camera angles, in color, and all that stuff. In fact, we also started to employ practical effects in this animated world. We were doing like
Think
Tank. Yeah, we got like, this is an experiment I've been doing in music videos and stuff where I wanted to always, and this is something I always wanted to do in the show, was use ink tanks, which are like, you know, aquariums filled with, you know, salt water and fresh water, and you inject ink to build clouds and atmosphere. You see it in like Flash Gordon skies, you see it in Poltergeist, Ghostbusters. It's an early technique, but there's something a little bit more tactile about it and dreamlike about it.
Yeah.
And so we did that, and that was a really fun thing. And not only that, we wanted to get new angles of the characters. And my brother works in practical effects. He works in, you know, a lot of different movies in different departments too. Sometimes he's a sculptor, sometimes he's a painter. Right now he's working at like different theme parks, building, you know, experiential rides and stuff like that. But
so is this like a mixed media thing when you say you're using practical effects, or?
No. So what we do is we take our ink tank cloud beds and we put them on the same frame rate as animation, so they really blend into our 2D world, you know? They don't feel like all of a sudden, oh, hey, look, it's totally, you know, photorealistic, you know, 3D background. It's not. We do something to it. We process it so it feels like it's part of our world, and we want to make sure we don't break that connection that we started from, you know, the first frame of the movie to the end.
Okay. Oh, that's awesome. I don't know that I have experienced it, but I didn't know I was, so I'm really looking forward to seeing this now.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, we really got moody with it. We really got, like, there were moments where we're like, ooh, let's do a Stanley Kubrick thing here. Let's just hypnotize the audience. You know, from the very beginning of the movie, I think it's always, I see so many movies where there's just walking and talking and exposition that just doesn't land over credits, and you're sitting there going, which way is up? What's going on here? And you have to kind of yield to it and eventually discover, you know, in your 10-minute mark, what the hell this movie's about. And then in our case, we're just like, let's do the thing. Let's just, like, swing a pocket watch and just try to hypnotize you into this place. I hope you're in a loud place. I hope you have a 5.1 stereo. I hope you're, you know, turn your phones off and take this thing in and watch it a few times and get something out of it that you didn't get the first time. Well, there's a lot of little tiny things we snuck in there for, like, rewatches.
You know, I think animation, like adult animation, I think it just gets, it's so underrated. I think people just automatically kind of classify it as just, I don't know, like lowbrow humor and all that stuff.
Yeah, but not that it isn't. It also is lowbrow humor.
Yeah, but it seems, it's pretty cool to see just all the different methods you're taking and, like, just infusing art with this, quite literally. So
yeah. I mean,
awesome.
Well, the question for me is, how do you make this interesting? Is, you know, am I going to go back and do the same thing again? No, I can't. I'll die doing that. I have to challenge myself, and I have to challenge the people around me. And then when they're challenged too, these people who have, you know, started out with a 1,000-yard stare, like another job, into, like, pitching ideas and getting excited about things. And now we're a team. Now we're like, oh, then everybody watches the ILM documentary, you know, on Disney Plus, and we all go, oh, did you see that one scene where they finally figured the thing out and blah, blah, blah. We're all getting excited, and we're, like, building a really exciting team where some of these people are real virtuosos. Our art director, Arthur Tang, I've never seen anybody like this dude. I did a pilot with him where we started kind of trying to do, like, it was kind of an early stage, like, employing the ink tanks, doing some rotoscope where I would, like, jump around and, like, jump into mattresses, and then we'd rotoscope me, you know, trace every single frame. Mm-hmm. And build this character out of it. And we really got excited by that. And so this guy, Arthur Tang, is a combination of a character designer, background designer, art director, and he can do anything. And having him on the team was bonkers. Plus, a really great compositor. And that's something else where the more I do animation, the more I kind of shape-shift the pipeline to what I want to see. You know, and so I don't do things in a traditional way. And so I bring compositing in earlier so the rest of the, you know, we glue the foreground, background, and, you know, elements, mood elements, you know, diffusion, haze, lighting, all that cool stuff, and really take it all into account, and really kind of use kind of grounded light logic that we can eventually, you know, accentuate and amplify and turn a little into something a little bit more spectacular, because this is heavy metal, and heavy metal needs a cool visual element. Have you ever seen an Iron Maiden album cover? It's the coolest thing in the world. A Slayer album cover. It looks like Bruegel or something like that. You know, it looks like this cool, crazy, medieval, dangerous, subterranean repugnance. So we're trying to, like, find all that stuff in there.
Man, I'm getting so excited. Like, all this technical jargon is getting me excited.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, the favorite, the music genre. So I have two more questions for you.
Sure, sure.
The first one, this has always reminded me of Metalocalypse, so I'd like to know if you've seen it and your opinions on it.
Yeah.
Have you seen Bat Metal?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know what? They're using our songs.
It sounded so similar.
Yeah. It's really funny. I don't know how this happened, but a bunch of dudes in either the Ukraine or Russia, who are really talented animators, took a couple of Death Clock songs. One of them is called Face Fisted, which is like a really silly song about getting into a fight. And it's really from the point of view of a dipshit who who just is like touting himself. And it's really just a stupid, stupid song. And it's really silly.
We all know those people, though.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it comes from, like, it's basically like 2 8-year-olds getting into a fight is kind of like how I think about it, you know?
Yeah.
Really like children, you know? And they did a video to it where it's like all these DC characters. And then they did one for another song of Death Clock, which is Awaken. So they just do Death Clock songs, and it's crazy. And they have, like, that kind of guttural, you know, Batman, who's, you know, like Christopher Nolan's Batman is kind of sounds like a death metal singer, too.
Yeah. So I had no idea it was actually your songs, but I was, every time I listened to it, I was like, man, this sounds like them. So I guess there we go.
I know, it's crazy. I like crossed my desk a long time ago, and I was like, whoa, this has a few million views. That's cool. That's nice.
So I just have one final question. So where can people find this Blu-ray? Like, is it going to be in physical stores? Do they have to order it from your website or Amazon?
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can definitely order it from anywhere. But it's also going to be in stores. So that's the cool thing about this is that, again, in this crazy world where shit's getting removed from streamers every other week or liquidating, everything must go, this has at least got its physical copy. And so many things don't get their physical copy. And then
I just got blocked out of Netflix today for sharing it with my ex-husband. So, no, I appreciate the physical aspect of it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So there you go. Yeah. So, no, seriously, I'm sitting here, I've got 4Ks of John Carpenter movies, and I love listening to commentaries or whatever it is, you know. I have so many movies, and the pandemic also was like, I would just buy boxes of Blu-rays, just sight unseen from, like, cool companies, little offshoots, and getting, like, weirdo movies, like strange cult cinema, and then, you know, of course, classics and all that stuff at the same time, high art, low art, all that stuff is, like, it's all very exciting to me, from Toxic Avenger to Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah. Oh, I love that vinyl is back. This generation is appreciating the physical and like nostalgic element of everything.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also an appreciation and a ritual kind of attached to music, which is kind of like, music is free, so who would give a shit about it right now, you know? Put on Spotify, turn down the ads, who gives a shit, right? Everyone's lazy, but a record means you get up.
You have to experience it versus consuming it. Yeah.
Exactly. And plus, you know, vinyl sounds, it adds an extra EQ curve to something. It makes everything warmer and makes it just kind of take you to a different time.
Yeah. So I know you're super busy and I really appreciate the time that you've given us today. Before we wrap up, is there anything that you'd like to share that we didn't already cover?
I mean, it's covered a lot. So we got a movie and 2 albums and a tour coming out with the band Baby Metal, so we'll be on the road soon. I start rehearsing tomorrow, and then I'm just like, then I'm on a carnival ride, like P.T. Barnum, trying to get everybody to come into the tent and see the wonders inside.
Have you met Baby Metal before this tour? Are you going to meet them for the first time on the first day?
Exactly, that's usually what happens. I met Mastodon when we toured with them on the first day. Basically everyone kind of lingers around, kind of checks each other out, introduces each other, and then you're just like, everyone's performing, and we're all a bunch of, like, it really is like a bunch of acrobats and, you know, bear trainers, and, like, you know, it just feels like we're in a circus.
Awesome. Well, I'm gonna let you go, but I'll have all the dates on our website, and I really appreciate your time, and if you're in or near North Carolina, I will do my best to see you at a show personally.
Awesome.
I'm excited for this premiere for you guys and everything that we've gone over today and before. So, you know, lots of luck, and I wish you lots of success.
Oh, thanks very much. I appreciate that. And thanks for spreading the word, too.
Oh, absolutely. I hope you have a great weekend.
All right. You too. I'll see you.
Thanks. Bye. Okay. Bye.